Congratulations on the Hall of Fame. When you received the notification that you were going to be one of the few people to ever be inducted, how did it hit you? What did you feel?
Honestly, it was a little bit of a mixed emotions. Obviously, I was proud and delighted. But there was a part of me that felt like, oh boy, that must mean I'm part of the old guys type of thing. And I usually get recognized for things like this in a later part of your profession, I guess. But also slightly guilty that, you know, obviously the successes I've had involve so many other people that it's slightly uncomfortable knowing that it's always been a team effort.
So you have something unique too in the fact that you have two generations before you, you know, that kind of paved the way, you came along with it. I mean, how does that register knowing your dad and your grandfather sort of paved this path for you to follow?
Well, exactly. I mean, that's one example of many of being blessed with such a support system around me, where my grandfather, Frank Dinelli at Northmore, to your point, back in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And then he had three sons, my dad, Joe, and then my uncle Jerry and uncle Jim. So all of them were golf course superintendents in the Chicago area. And so I never really questioned what I was going to do for a living, and I absolutely love it. So I feel super fortunate in that regard as well, that it's such a rewarding, challenging business to be part of. And golf itself, you know, just the wonderful attributes that golf contributes to beyond even the game itself, you know, raising funds for certain charities and whatnot, and for donations to help people. We've been fortunate at North Shore Country Club to be involved with several significant golf events that's just, you know, evolved around raising funds for charity. And my personal, I guess, thing that I gravitated towards is the environment. You know, being 20 miles north of one of the biggest cities of Chicago and having 170 acres of open green space with healthy plants contributing to the environment that is just good for the community, the wildlife, the ecosystem. So it's a very, to me, it's golf is a very, you know, there's a lot of layers to it, and it goes pretty deep if you start thinking about it. And I tried my best with the team around me to emphasize these things and enhance the environmental attributes, especially.
So you mentioned challenging times in there. Is there a moment that stands out? You know, I'm sure there's many times throughout your career where you're like, I can't believe this is happening. Is there one, though, that stands out where, like, you had to face something really difficult and then it worked and you said, well, this is why I stayed in this business?
Ooh, Walter, you're hitting a chord with that one. One sticks out was when the club was debating the value of redoing our old push-up POA greens that were built in 1924 when the course was established. So that was quite an undertaking to, I guess, do the homework, the background, the research to, I guess, justify not just the expense, but the downtime to do such a project. It's a big deal. I understand it, but it was quite an effort to go through that process. And looking back, I don't think there's a single person that regrets or debates the value in doing such an act. But there's also a lot of other things. You know, I'm old enough now where I've seen a few ups and downs in golf itself. You know, we kind of enjoy the Tiger Wood effect, so to speak, and now the COVID effect. So COVID has created a great surge in golf, which has been wonderful, brought a lot of young people to the game, which is just so much fun to watch and see. I guess moving forward or looking ahead, what's concerning me now is riding this high, knowing that at some point there's going to be a downturn, so to speak, whether it's driven by the overall economy and whatnot. And since COVID, things have gotten so expensive that to ensure golf stays accessible and healthy, I feel this urge to try to really dial in tight how to do things more sustainably and kind of working more with natural systems instead of kind of against the grain a little bit and reduce the costs. I don't know exactly what that looks like because we, you know, we're really careful how we spend money now, but we're going to have to be creative, I think, at some point to ensure the health and well-being of the activity of golf. So these facilities stay healthy and it welcomes a broad group of players.
So one of the things that I think you've done really well at is you share a lot of information, especially on LinkedIn, about the process. And a lot of times, like you talked about reducing costs. What are you doing to ensure the healthy of the plants, but also, you know, to make it so it fits with what the expectations are for your members? Now, there was one thing you posted a video recently about your high capacity deep well, and that it goes into an aquifer that's 1,400 feet deep. Can you explain what that is? Because I found that fascinating.
Yes. So we're just starting that process now. About every 10 years, you need to pull everything out of the ground, meaning the pump and the motor and the wire and the casing, to evaluate it and rebuild those parts. Because it's all, like you said, the wellhead itself is about 900 feet down, but the hole, the cavity, if you will, is 1,400 feet. That's reaches the Galesville Aquifer. There's only one aquifer below that, the Mount Simon, 2,200 feet. And after that, that's it. So the earth is fascinating in the sense that it's built like a layer cake, if you will. And these different layers have different materials, parent materials. So the sandstone-like materials tend to be the aquifers and carry the water. And then usually they're separated by like shale-like material, which is pretty impervious. So this is all the ancient ocean beds back in the day. And where our water comes from, ironically, is around the Baraboo area. So that sandy formation outcrops there. So in other words, you can pour water nonstop at North Shore Country Club on the surface, and it'll never reach that aquifer. It'll reach the first aquifer and replenish that area. But the aquifer we pull from, which is considered a high capacity aquifer, meaning we can get 500 gallons a minute out of it, that water actually comes from, like I said, around the Baraboo area north of Madison, and travels all the way down to us and others to offer a pretty high water quality.
Yeah, that's fascinating how you could see all these things kind of tie together. But like you said, ancient oceans, it's hard to kind of put grips around that, knowing that golf only started in this area in like the 1890s. So, you know, and it's probably a good segue in terms of like your thinking. You have to do a lot of long-term thinking, I would imagine, right? You're going to, like you talked about the green renovation project, you're going to make decisions today that probably won't pay off for years. What do you think, after all this time in your career, how does that impact the long-term thinking you make in your life, but also that you teach, you know, whether it's, you know, the guys that work for you or the people around you?
Well, Walter, I think that's a very important point. I'm glad you brought that up, because we seem to be getting more and more transient. So there's trade-offs with everything in life, right? But I was fortunate to be at one facility my entire career. And so that's fairly unique. And the lessons I've learned, to your point, is the value in and the need to look long-term, because the tendency is to do short, quick fixes. And the way I try to verbalize that sometimes is, we've come pretty good at firefighting as a whole, I guess, as an industry in a way. But we need to do better at preventing fires, if that makes sense. So some of that means investing in things that you may not witness much of an impact initially, but long term will pay dividends. And when you're at a place long enough like I have, and sometimes you're forced into doing these other compromises just because simply the money's not there, or what have you, or the time or the resources. But, you know, you learn firsthand that taking that long-term approach is really, assuming the facility wants to stick around, you know, if it's going to be a short-lived facility for whatever reason, that's in a different, you know, system. But yeah, there's a lot of value into investing long-term, I think.
And another part of that, or two parts of that, I would assume, are the aspects of discipline and patience, right? You can't force the grass to grow any faster. You can't control the weather. How has working with nature on a daily basis for your entire career taught you patience?
Well, it's kind of like the earth. There's layers to all this, I think would be one way to visualize it. And as you kind of get comfortable with a layer of knowledge within a biological system that acts more like a web, where you pull on one string and it yanks on several others, I guess you get used to, or I guess realize, that it's a very complex system that we will really never fully understand. And at best, we can understand aspects of it that we can influence, that can you can steer towards sustainability. And you know, and you can go down these rabbit holes agronomically, and I try my best to always reflect back to the golfer, because you know, some of this is like, you know, making the sausage and people just aren't interested in it. But it does reflect on playability, not just function and cost perhaps, but also how the course performs. And so yeah, I think it's a critical part of it.
So you mentioned about that most of us, you know, golfers are probably not interested in making the sausage. Was there a time when you weren't interested in making the sausage, or is that something you kind of grew into since you were born into this, or what's been your kind of process for that?
I've always enjoyed nature and was, you know, always been curious and fascinated by how all of this works, whether it's human health, plant health, what have you. It's magical. I mean, it's when you really stop and think about the detail and the attributes and the interactions that exist in life, it's fascinating. And I think part of that came from my grandfather, where that era, that generation, they didn't have all these inputs like we have access to today. And so they had to work more in line with natural systems. You know, it's kind of like how we romanticize about Native Americans, or Native, you know, people that lived in nature, if you will. And we reflect on that as kind of being a brutal time, perhaps, because it's so difficult and hard for us to relate to today, since we've been so far removed from natural systems, unfortunately. But that's really, in a nutshell, the more sustainable approach. A lot of these shortcuts, just you usually pay for these things later, if that makes sense. There's usually a price to pay.
So that actually brings up a good point. So you're at the intersection of nature and technology on a daily basis. How has artificial intelligence changed the way you're doing your job and will be doing your job?
So I'm just trying to get my feet wet with that now. Some of these videos you mentioned, I've been using AI to help produce. I think it's going to be very impactful. Right now, unless I'm not using the right AI programs, you really have to learn how to ask it the right questions. If you just start with a very broad question, it usually just picks up what's out there, so to speak, and responds in a fairly broad spectrum. But when I try to pull different scientific disciplines together and relate it to golf and, you know, a USGA red zone, for example, that's pretty unique, it struggles. So you have to ask a series of, what I've learned, at least my experience has been, that you have to ask very specific questions first, have a dialogue, and then ask it to summarize this and relate it. And if you're fortunate, it can do that and sew these things together, because in a way, in an awkward way, the scientific method oversimplifies biology in many ways. It's the way we do things right now, but usually you can't just pick a single element out and feel like studying that single element tells the story about how these biological systems work, because it's a network. Just the microbes alone, we recognize the importance that it's a community of organisms. And that's another message I try to portray, is that we really aren't just managing turf grass, as weird as it may sound. We're actually managing the turf grass ecosystem, so the turf itself continues to be a self-sustaining, self-healing surface that we can play the game on, in hopes that you know, it reduces costs and inputs and needs from us.
So I have three more questions for you. I'm assuming that a tremendous amount has changed since you got in the business in terms of technology, regulations, probably even member expectations. How do you stay adaptable while maintaining the, you know, the disciplines, the core principles that you learned at an early age?
Well, that's part of the fun of it, is trying to meet all those, and you just evolve with it and try to be actually slightly ahead of it if you can. And we got, at the end of the day, it is about golf, and it's about the golfer and the golf experience. But it's also, you know, about safety and sustainability, as I've been mentioning. So you just continue to evolve and explore and learn. And like I said, you know, part of your first question is what I reflected on. It's like, I don't even want to think about retirement, because I feel like there's so much more to do and so much more to learn. And I feel like I'm just starting to get some momentum at 65 years of age. So it's, you know, spending a life at it. So part of it's a little frustrating, because it's kind of like working a 3D puzzle, if you will, that's so huge you'll never finish it. But it's encouraging to work on it long enough and be successful at it to visualize some kind of an image that the puzzle's trying to illustrate.
So from a golfer's perspective, I can't imagine a more pressure-packed role than a superintendent at a premier club like yours. There's got to be huge expectations. There's got to be the traditions you got to uphold. How do you handle that pressure?
It stimulates me. I mean, I won't deny, sometimes, you know, I get a little anxious. And I spend a lot of hours doing it. It's kind of both my livelihood and my hobby, if you will, you can say. But I'm not alone. You know, there's plenty of us like that. Superintendents as a whole are very dedicated people. But like I said, I've been blessed to have such a crew around me to give me the ability and the freedoms, if you will, to loosen my grip around, like, say, daily tasks. Where Juan Villarreal, for example, you know, he attended the ceremony, and he just retired that same week after being working at North Shore for 51 years. And I have the Ocampo brothers there for 30 years. We're all kind of coming to a head at the same time as far as our age goes. But when you have a nucleus like that in a team, it allows me a little more flexibility to, I guess, focus on the question you asked and try my best. You know, we use things like satisfaction surveys, and honestly, just being around the club every day and just getting daily feedback keeps you kind of up to date, in such a sense that you rarely feel like you're falling behind. You're able to react quickly. So that daily contact, I think, is important, so you don't fall behind and become overwhelmed with the expectations and trying to meet them.
So then that's a good place to finish up. Last question would be about your team. Like you mentioned, you don't do this alone. You have all these folks that you've been with, many of them for a long time. What have you learned about leadership from managing this team for your entire career?
I would say nothing probably revolutionary, but it is critical that everyone feels that we're all in it together. And so what that usually boils down to is that you could just see that if you ever were to, like, just step away from it for a bit, let's say you get too tied up with, like, a big project on long range planning that takes you away from being with the crew physically for a few days. There's almost like a disconnect that happens, almost like naturally. And it's not like they need me to do their daily job per se. They're so good at it. It's just that everyone needs to feel like we're in it together, all working towards the same vision, the same goals. And you, it's, you know, so back in the day when it's changing a little bit now, the what do they call it, the work-life balance or whatever they call it. But I mean, being seasonal, we were there 7 days a week, literally. I mean, it's just, that's the way it was. It's golf. It's like, you know, it's just the way it is. Things got to be mowed every day and whatnot. So you had to be there with them every day. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And then everybody recognizes that even though it gets tiresome sometimes and it wears on you, especially if the weather's working against you, that's the biggest thing. If things are going pretty good and the weather's cooperating for the most part, it's a joy. It's so rewarding. But sometimes you slip backwards and you work harder during those times and you still slip backwards, probably, you know, usually due to weather events that you'll catch up at some point, but it makes you stronger ultimately for the next challenge.